Committee on Health and Human Services Finance will come to order. Do you have a motion to approve the minutes for March 3rd, 2015?
Yep,
I do. Representative Gruenhagen moves approval of the minutes for March 3rd, 2015. Are there any corrections? Seeing no corrections, all those in favor of adoption, please say aye. Those opposed, no. Minutes are approved.
Just to confirm.
Representative Davids, welcome back to our committee, and you have House File 189. And I would like to move House File 189 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. Representative Davids, you have an author's amendment, A2. I will move A2, the A2 amendment. Representative Davids, could you describe what the A2 does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. The A2 amendment basically just defines each region, breaks down on a countywide basis.
Any questions? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Davids, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of HHS Finance. House File 189 basically just transfers authority of the 8 regional emergency medical systems from the EMSRB, the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board, to the Department of Health. I'm not aware of any opposition to this fine piece of legislation, but I'd like Mr. McAlpin to briefly describe it, if that would be okay, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davids, Mr. McAlpin, welcome to the committee. Please announce yourself for the record and tell us where you're from and a little bit about why you're here.
Mr. Chair and members, Buck McAlpin of the Minnesota Ambulance Association. Representative Davids is right. We've worked with all the key stakeholders in this. And as we've talked about in the policy side of it, there was some problems that we've looked at before about some of the conflicts of interest that many of us as peers serve on the EMS board. And we're voting for these grants that may go to providers. And with just some resources and aligning it better with what we do with trauma and stroke and cardiac care, the industry worked with the EMS board to transfer these programs over to the Department of Health.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. Is there any questions? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no testifiers, I will renew my motion that House File 189, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. 189 is laid over for possible inclusion. Next up, we have House File 213, also from Representative Davids. I will move House File 213 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. We have the bill before us. Representative Davids, you have an author's amendment, A1 amendment. I will move the A1 amendment. Representative Davids, to the A1 amendment.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm going to defer to Mr. Buck McAlpin to describe the A1 amendment.
Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair and members, the A1 amendment was brought to us by the health plans, county-based purchasing. Although this is for fee-for-service, the rate reduction as part of the budget fixing back in 2009 also included a reduction in the health plan managed care rates to us, and this would just tell the Department of Human Services, as the fiscal note was done, which does reflect the reduction to managed care, that the managed care rates would be increased in their contracts to be able to reimburse the non-emergency providers and the ambulance services.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. Do you have testifiers for your bill, Representative Davids?
Not that I'm aware of.
I do have Ms. Averholden from NAMI. Is she here? She is here. Welcome. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Averholden. Oh, you have a question on the amendment? Well, you're getting ready there, Mr. McAlpin. If you could, Representative Liebling has a question regarding the A1 amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't think we adopted it yet either. I don't know if you intended to do that before we discuss the bill. But, Mr. McAlpin, does this language just increase the rates to the degree that they were decreased under a previous cut? I mean, I just sometimes when we pass along increases and we just add it to the capitated rate, we have no way, of course, of knowing that this goes to the intended recipient. And I just want to know if there's any hope of that happening here, or any guarantee of it happening, I should say. Can you speak to that?
Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lulee, and that's correct. In the original reduction, it did detail that the managed care would be reduced in county-based purchasing. So this just correlates back to the 2009 reduction that states, and the fiscal note also reflects that this money would go back to reimburse the providers.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And were the, when the cuts happened, was that cut from the capitation rate as well? Were those rates adjusted downward?
Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I do believe they were.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. All right. Representative Liebling reminds us we need to adopt the A1 amendment. So all those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The A1 amendment is adopted. Ms. Aberholden is now down and ready to testify. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Aberholden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Sue Aberholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and actually here as the co-chair of the Non-Emergency Medical Transportation Advisory Committee. And just wanted to let you know that the committee certainly believes that we need to raise the rates for non-emergency medical transportation. The 4.5% cut has been in place for some time now and does have a negative impact on the industry. I wanted to let you know that in terms of the priorities for the advisory committee, the first was to increase personal mileage reimbursement, hoping that as more people took their own cars that we could reduce other costs. But second was the 4.5% rateable buyback. So just wanted to make sure that the committee knew that.
Thank you, Ms. Aberholden. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just I know Ms. Aberholden has kind of wandered away from the table now, but this wasn't so much a question as just I wanted to just be really clear about what's going on here with this task force that's been working really hard over a long period of time, because this bill, and I think some others on our agenda here, relate to this as well. And so when she says that this is the second priority, I think what she's saying, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what you're saying is if we don't enact the first priority, we shouldn't just rush ahead and do this, the other pieces, that there's an overall strategy here that the task force came up with, and this is indeed a piece of it, but it's important that we not just do this piecemeal. Is that accurate?
Ms. Aberholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, I would say yes, because what we all wanted to do was to make sure that people are taking the cheapest transportation possible, which is personal mileage. But again, they wanted to make sure that, I mean, there was a third priority as well, increasing the volunteer mileage. And the bill representing the work of the task force was just introduced this week, which has all the components. But I don't want to take away the fact that our providers have been cut by 4.5% how many years now? Several years, which really is problematic, especially in the rural areas.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no other testifiers, Representative Davids, anything else?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, just basically what we're doing is we're sunsetting the 4.5% rate cut. I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Davis. Any final questions or comments from the members? Seeing none, all those in favor, I will renew my motion that House File 213 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. House File 213, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Chairman Davids, for coming back to our committee. You are always welcome and appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you. Next up, members, we have Representative Schumacher's House File 380 and House File 261 from Representative Mack, and they are en route. And we will just take a brief pause, not a recess, but a pause as they come back. So there he is. Representative Schumacher has joined us. Welcome, Representative Schumacher. Representative Schumacher is bringing to us House File 380. Representative Schumacher moves House File 380 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. We now have the bill before us. Representative Schumacher, would you like to move your bill and speak to your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I would like to move this bill to be laid over for possible inclusion. House File 380 is the rural and urban commuting areas, and those are areas that are determined to be rural, urban, or super rural by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Service. The RUCA categories are based on the size and the city of the town and the delay commuting for the population. Medical transportation services are reimbursed when they're provided for an eligible MHCP recipient to and from the site of an MHCP-covered medical service or by an enrolled and by an enrolled MHCP healthcare transportation provider. The problem that we come up with, members, is when the no-load miles are considered, because they're not reimbursed, and in greater Minnesota, those no-load miles are greater than they typically are in the metro area. This disadvantages transportation providers in rural and super rural areas who ultimately travel greater distance for transporting Minnesota patients. The RUCA adjustment to the base rate and mileage is intended to account only for this disparity and is calculated for the, right now it's calculated for the loaded miles only. When RUCA became law in 2009, this program was funded, but only halfway, so this would help fund the other half from the 2009 legislation. This proposed legislation fully funds the RUCA adjustments for our rural and super rural special transportation providers serving the MHCP patients.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher, and you have testifiers for your bill?
No testifiers, but I think Mr. Buck here is able to answer questions of
Mr.
members.
Mr. McAlpin, thanks. Welcome back to the committee.
And sure, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks again, Buck McAlpin, Ambulance Association. We've worked on this with the rural non-emergency providers. As we all know, that when non-emergency is not available, as Ms. Aberholden alluded to, the importance of rural Minnesota. A couple things. There's also the non-emergency task force bill that Representative Liebling talked about that has some RUCA language in there that expands RUCA to more of the access providers. And our legislation that we brought forward early before that bill was introduced increases this fully funded. I was very happy when I saw the fiscal note on it to our rural providers. But they just have so many deadhead miles that they're not covered for. There's really only 8 or 9 large ones left in rural Minnesota we're trying to help hold up. So we'd appreciate your support with it.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin and Representative Schumacher. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm a city girl, and I'm still learning the right terms, and I learned from former Speaker Sfigum at the One Minnesota Conference about deep rural, and now we have super rural, and I'm not sure if they're same, so can you tell me how many counties in Minnesota are super rural?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, that's a great question. where this came from and we put this together was one of the one federal pieces of legislation I ever worked on in past was for rural ambulance services. And it's obviously not in our large MSA designations like Duluth or Rochester or Mankato, but there is a map that we could provide you that does have the super rural. So for Medicare, for ambulance, the super rural is a 22.6% bonus payment for Medicare ambulance rates in rural Minnesota, and then rural is 3%, and then urban gets a 2% bump annually that provides that for our high volume of Medicare. As we know, rural Minnesota, Medicare and Medicaid is our major payer mix now, so they looked at that in super rural to try to maintain some reimbursement. We kind of emulated that same formula for Medicaid in Minnesota in 2009 for a RUCA program for non-emergency transportation. But the big counties aren't in it. It is truly the super rural counties that it falls under.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, it makes a lot of sense. I just thought I'd like to see a map of what super rural looks like.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. We have rural, deep rural, super rural. Is there anything more rural than super rural, Mr. McAlpin?
I think that's it, Mr. Chair.
That's
we'll come
rural
up with a fee if we could for it.
Yeah, we could.
All right. Any other questions for the testifier or the author? Representative Pearson.
So what would the average dollar amount increase be on these types of trips?
Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not sure exactly we could get that to you about how much that would increase, but I know it goes mostly to the base for mileage. But it's like $1.85, I believe, for non-emergency transportation mileage. And it would come up from there.
All right. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Mr. McAlpin, could you just, again, kind of the same question as before, how does this fit into the task force bill, or does it?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. The non-emergency bill that was just introduced this last week, the big task force bill that many of us have worked on with the committee, there is some RUCA stuff in there that increases some of it to access transportation, the other mode, and also to what we're doing with rural transportation. This legislation right here just right now focuses on the super rural and the major part of the rural parts of RUCA. So I think if that bill moves forward too, once we get to conference committee and work on the omnibus bill, we would have a discussion about how what's in that task force bill and ours, Representative Liebling, would merge together.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to decipher that a little bit. So I think you're saying that this is not exactly in the task force bill, and it's not that it's in conflict with it, but it's sort of additional to it. Is that
Mr. McAlpin?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, before we knew there was going to be a task force bill, we drafted this early, like in December, and you are correct. This is different than what's in the task force bill. They both address RUCA, but the current task force bill expands it to access transportation, which is more folks that can walk and get into a non-emergency van, compared to the special transportation, we refer to it now, where it's more wheelchair type or monitored clients that get those rides.
And Mr. Chair?
Representative Liebling.
I don't know if Ms. Abderholden was going to testify on this one as well, but if she's in the room, it'd be great if she would step up and...
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you.
She is coming down. Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, members, Sue Abderholden, NAMI Minnesota, co-chair of the non-emergency medical transportation. This was a much, much lower priority, probably, I think it was like six. So it was kind of on the list, but not near the top.
Okay. And
is not included in the major bill.
Okay.
And Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Abderholden, so I gather from that, so the committee was not opposed to this, but when we talk about what the priorities are, that was because the committee had in mind that there was going to be a certain pot of funding to implement a big change in the way we do non-emergency medical transportation across the whole state, right? And so it's not a policy objection or anything. It's just a matter of how far the money's going to go and where the committee as a whole felt like it should be put first. If there was, like, you know, if there was unlimited money, you're saying, I'm sure we'd get down this far, but the committee didn't think we were going to do that.
Ms. Abderholden.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, while we were dreamers, we did keep our feet somewhat on the ground.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Liebling. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McAlpin, I was just curious, maybe even Ms. Abderholden could answer this, just in regards to that bill for the, thank you, Mrs. Abderholden. I just got done finished reading that with the miles and the 18 to 50 miles adjustment. Is it, do you know, in the current bill that was just introduced for the non-emergency medical transportation, was that less than what is included in Representative Schumacher's bill?
Ms. Abderholden.
Mr. Chairman, Representative McDonald, it was not changed in the task force bill, so this is different. What the task force did under RUCA was expand it so that the what we now call and still call access transportation, if they were driving long distances, that was taken into account as well. And I think it was hoped that if the 4.5% increase went away, that would help everyone, because RUCA's on top of that.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Does anyone else have any questions, particularly for Ms. Abderholden? Seeing none. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Mr. McAlpin. Does anyone else in the audience like to testify for or against this bill? Seeing no one, any further comments from the committee members? Seeing none, anything further, Mr. Chair and author? Seeing none, Representative Schumacher renews his motion that House File 380 be held over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House File 380 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Chair Schumacher, Mr. McAlpin, Ms. Albert Holden. Next up, we have House File 261, Representative Mack. Next up on the docket, Representative Mack, welcome to the committee. You have House File 261. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I will move that House File 261 be re-referred to... I'm not exactly sure what the motion is. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mack, I believe your motion is to lay it over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. And I believe you have a A3 author's amendment as well.
That is correct, Mr. Chair. So I will move my bill, and I would like to also move the A3 amendment.
Representative Mack moves the A3 amendment. Is there any questions for Representative Mack on the A3 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Could we just get a brief explanation of what it's doing?
Representative Mack, you could give just a brief description of the A3 amendment to your bill.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling. Members, the A3 amendment has a few different pieces to it, just some technical cleanup as well as clarifying who's going to be involved in some of the decision-making as this program is developed. I don't know if you necessarily want me to walk line by line or if we want to have House research do that, but we, on page 2, line 21, we dealt with some concerns that were brought forward in terms of some terms that were used. We delete the term episodic population health there. On page 2, line 31, we clarify what a CEMT may not do within certain statutes of law. On page 3, on 1.12 of the amendment, we're including a few more stakeholders into the decision-making process that the commissioner will consult with in developing services and rates that will be done within the program. And then the last few lines of the amendment are some cleanup in terms of a date change and clarifying who's involved in the process.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Mack. I mean, it sounds from that description like you've been working with some stakeholders and that this is kind of the result of that work, and you're nodding, and thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, we have been working since it was in the Health Reform Committee. The stakeholders have been working very closely together for which I'm very grateful. I will say, and you'll hear today in the hearing, there is certainly not 100% peace in the valley, and you'll have testimony to that effect, but I think we've made huge strides in getting this thing in the right direction.
Thank you. Other questions for Representative Mack on the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Mack, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll do a very brief introduction and then turn it over to the experts here. Mr. Chair, this bill is basically trying to build on something that we did, I think, 4 years ago now when we developed the nation-leading legislation that was the Community Paramedic Bill. This legislation is going to create a new certification called Community EMT, and it follows along the lines of the successful Community Paramedic Program. And just for so people know, the implementation of the Community Paramedic Program, when used, has resulted in significant lack or reduction in readmission into hospitals. We've seen a lot of dollars being saved. Right now, there's a pilot project going on with the medical response units of Eden Prairie, Minnetonka, St. Louis Park, Hopkins, Minneapolis, and the Park Nicollet Health System that is doing this very thing that we're trying to implement on a statewide basis, and are finding that there's a 50% reutilization reduced when a community paramedic or EMT follows up within 48 hours of release from the hospital. So, members, we're trying to address a lot lot of the challenges that we see in Health and Human Services when it comes to readmissions. We all know the high cost, both in real dollars and just on people's lives when they are not properly taking care of themselves, not sure what to do when they're released from the hospital. We're utilizing some of our great professionals in the health, in our healthcare workforce with paramedics and now EMTs, that they could just help follow up with these patients, go to their homes, make sure that they have what they need, that they don't have any questions. We all know that when you leave the hospital, sometimes directions can be confusing and overwhelming, and this is something that we think kind of fills that gap in a very logical, responsible way to make sure that we're delivering better health care. And in some of the rural communities where access can be an issue or very inconvenient for patients, this could be a huge tool. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to our testifiers.
Thank you, Ms. Mack. And is that Mr. Parsons?
Yes, sir.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record. Let us know where you are representing and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Chris Parsons. I'm president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters, representing over 1,600 professional firefighters, EMTs, paramedics, dispatchers in over 40 communities throughout the state of Minnesota. Pardon me. I'd like to thank the committee for hearing this bill today. I'm here to express my organization's full and unyielding support for HF 261, which continues Minnesota's long and proud tradition of delivering quality and innovative health care while simultaneously stemming the ever-increasing cost of health care to the consumer and taxpayer. The status quo is no longer a viable option as it threatens to bankrupt our state and nation. Minnesota's fire service, with its thousands of trained health care professionals located in every corner of the state, is perfectly suited to deliver the fruits of HF 261, whether it be urban, rural, metro, or greater Minnesota. HF 261 is progressive, it's bipartisan, and it has the potential to improve healthcare outcomes and control costs at the same time. It addresses gaps in the healthcare system that all stakeholders have explicitly acknowledged and provides for public-private partnerships that are already proving to provide system-wide benefits. Also, please consider that it is leading to the creation of services that are not currently being provided anywhere else in the healthcare system. Today's firefighters do more than fight fires. All of Minnesota's 1,600 professional firefighters are either EMTs or paramedics, with thousands more paid on call and volunteer firefighters being trained to these levels as well. In fact, healthcare delivery is over 80% of what we do in a day, 24 hours a day and every day of the year. I have here in my hand the firefighter job description from the City of St. Paul website, and I don't mean to brag, but here are some of the tasks that I and my colleagues are expected to perform. We provide basic and or advanced level life support of patient care to ensure that life-threatening situations and potentially serious injuries are recognized and cared for appropriately. We determine the nature and extent of illness or injury and prioritize medical procedures and or treatment plans, observe, record, and report situations or status of patient to medical facility or dispatch, and we are responsive and respectful of patients, families, and medical staff. In addition to these skills, the professionals I represent deliver life-saving medications, read and interpret 12-lead EKGs, deliver other needed interventions, often at the scene of devastating accidents or while immersed in the wails and screams of desperate and grieving family members standing nearby. We do not have the luxury of utilizing our skills in a controlled environment like a hospital or clinic. But day in and day out, Minnesota's firefighters literally bring the benefits of the emergency room to the patient's side wherever they may be. Firefighters are also among the most highly regarded and trusted members of the community. We know the people of our communities because we are in their homes hundreds of times per day attending to the various problems. We see how they live and often can readily identify their needs. We are backgrounded, badged, and sworn to fulfill our duty of protecting life and property. Thus, it makes perfect sense for firefighters to be engaged in community medicine. The current pilot program involving Park Nicollet Methodist Hospital and surrounding fire departments is proving to be a successful public-private partnership. It is also spreading from the West Metro to the East, with a partnership being begun at Regents Hospital with the St. Paul Fire Department. What I like is the program is elegant in its simplicity, especially when you take into account the highly technical skills firefighters are expected to demonstrate daily. We are simply just visiting folks in their homes and checking boxes. We ask questions like, do you have your meds? Check. Do you have a ride to your next appointment? Check. Could that rug be a trip fall hazard? Check. We are providing reassurance. In my personal experience and the data prove that that's all it takes to avoid a costly ambulance ride, an ER visit, and a hospital stay. We are helping keep people in their homes and out of the hospital, which is the most cost-effective and, frankly, patient-friendly way to deliver health care. In crafting this legislation, the pilot program, we have sought consensus from all sectors of the healthcare system while being mindful not to encroach on the current services and skills being practiced by other groups. Professional firefighters, fire chiefs, League of Cities, LPNs, APLNs, and home service providers have all signed off on this legislation. The continued resistance is based on the argument of patient safety and scope of practice infringement. These come off as baseless when coupled with the professionalism and care that firefighters and EMTs and paramedics currently provide. The skill level needed for the current Park-Nicolet pilot program hardly rise to the skill level of an EMT, much less that of a registered nurse. Finally, let's allow Minnesota to continue to be a progressive leader in the emerging frontier of community medicine by recognizing that there are many groups interested and capable of stepping up and providing quality health care at a lower cost to consumers and taxpayers. Please support HF 261.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do believe there's a few other testifiers.
Okay. We have on the list Roxana Gapstor from Park-Nicolet. I don't know if she's here. If she is. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and who you represent and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roxana Gapstor. I'm the Chief Operating Officer and Chief Nursing Officer at Park-Nicolet Health Services and Methodist Hospital in St. Louis Park. And I'm here today to testify in support of House File 261. Our organization, which is part of the Health Partners Care Group, is committed to high-quality care. And one of our goals is the Triple Aim. Some of you may have heard of the Triple Aim, but it is really very high quality, great patient experience, coupled with affordability. We started the hospital transition project with our local fire department in St. Louis Park a little over a year ago. And the work to date has been tremendously exciting and also very heartwarming when we hear the stories that our patients and families tell us about the firefighter visits. The visits began as a way of preventing patients who go home from the hospital from calling 911 or trying to access emergency services when they actually don't particularly need those kind of services. They just may be confused about particular things. They may live alone. They may have other issues. And so we began the project with Steve Coring, who's our fire chief in St. Louis Park. He actually approached us at the hospital and asked us about visiting patients at home because their experience with it was that they were seeing these 911 calls and these emergency calls. Our pilot program actually was designed to achieve a few things. One of those things was to reduce hospital readmissions, but also just to ensure that patients were following up with their primary care provider after they were discharged from the hospital. We do make nurse phone calls to our patients within 48 hours of discharge, and that is to all of our patients who are discharged from the hospital. But sometimes questions come up before that 48 hours of time expires. As part of the pilot, there's no cost to patients or to insurers. It's a free program where firefighters are visiting patients for about 15 to 20 minutes the day after they're discharged from the hospital. All of our patients consent to the visits while they're still in the hospital, so they are asked if they would like to have a firefighter visit, and they are able to consent to that at that time. In addition to checking in with the patients about whether they were able to pick up their prescriptions and whether they know when their next appointment is, firefighters are also checking a few other things for safety. One of those things is to identify whether there's food in the home. So identifying patients with food insecurity and referring them to a food shelf, our local food shelves will actually deliver food right to the door if patients don't have nourishing food after discharge. We have referred more than 50 patients to local food shelves to obtain food after discharge from the hospital. The patient surveys that we've done on our firefighter visit program have been extremely positive. We have nearly 100% patient satisfaction with the program. Our firefighter program does not replace the important work that our home care nurses do at Park Nicollet. We do have a home care agency associated with our organization, and many patients who qualify for home care services will receive those services. However, as many of you may be aware, those services have very strict criteria, often set by Medicare, and a lot of patients don't qualify for nursing home care services. Those patients that don't qualify can sometimes receive free visits through one of our other nurse programs. We do that. Or they can receive just a quick visit from our firefighters before they go back in to see their primary care provider, hopefully within a couple days of discharge. Since starting the program, we've had more than a 50% reduction in our readmission rate at Methodist Hospital, which has been a tremendous win for both our patients and our community, as well as for affordability. With today's healthcare environment, the complexity and the affordability issues, it's really important for us to be able to innovate and to share with community partners in some of the strategies that we're trying, especially with the firefighter program. It's one of our most innovative things that we've done in quite some time at Methodist Hospital. So we would just like to say we would support the House File 261, and also we believe that our patients and families would also support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gafter. Any questions? Representative Merkel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Gabster, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. And Representative Mack, you know, in the past, and I have a cold, so that's why I have this great voice. I carried legislation to create the community health worker. You carried legislation to create the community paramedic, and here we are now with a community EMT. And I'm trying to understand just a little bit more, Ms. Gabster, if you can help me understand what kind of patients this kind of provider would be seeing, and is there an interval of visits that would be recommended, or is this a one visit after a discharge and then on we go? Can you just tell us a little bit more about how this works?
Sure. Thank you, Representative Murphy. It is one visit. It is the day after discharge for about 15 or 20 minutes. So it's one visit only. It is not ongoing visits.
And Mr. Chair, thank you. And Ms. Gabster, that's helpful for me to understand. In the language of the bill, they talk about, and this is on page 3, some of the functions of the role. And some of them give me pause, and I hope that I can work with Representative Mack and others on this as we go forward. This is the first time I've seen the bill, but I am concerned about what is, from my perspective, a high-level function of diagnosis-related patient education and population-based preventative education as functions of this role in that one-day visit post-op or post-hospitalization. And as a practicing nurse in a hospital, I, you know, recognize the critical value of diagnosis-related patient education, about discharge-related education, and especially population-based preventative education. And too often those are things that can't happen in a hospital anymore, and yet they're really critical to the well-being of patients being discharged, and I think critical to the potential readmission. But I'm not certain that the educational preparation of an EMT is satisfactory to be able to really manage that, and that's no slight to EMTs. They play a really important role, and as Mr. Parsons was just describing what they do, they are, you know, in the thick of often very high test critical points in a person's care that require real skill, but that is different than doing especially population-based preventative education. So I want to flag that. I'd love to know your response to that right now, and then I want to say that I hope that I can work with Representative Mack going forward, especially on the work that this role would conduct.
Ms. Gabster.
I'm just wondering, Ms. Gabster, if you have thinking about especially those functions for this role.
Oh, so how this has actually worked in actual fact is if the firefighters at the patient's home and they say, gosh, I don't understand XYZ on our discharge instruction, we have our triage primary care line that they are able to have the patient access, or they can talk to a primary care nurse right there about their discharge instructions. And it is our primary care nurses who are making those discharge phone calls afterwards. because often our patients are going back to their primary clinic, you know, afterwards.
And so, Mr. Chair and Ms. Gabster, are you suggesting that the role is really about facilitating that education?
I don't want to speak to Representative Maxfield in terms of what she intends with the bill. But just in actual practice, what has happened is, yes, they've facilitated a call to the patient's primary care physician, which is the person who knows that patient the best.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. We have two other testifiers that have signed up ahead of time. They are Matt Keller and Stacy Enger from the Minnesota Nurses Association. If either of those two are available to testify, please come down to the testifier table. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and where you represent and proceed with your testimony.
Yes, my name is Stacy Enger. I work at Methodist Hospital in the emergency department. Good afternoon, Chair and committee members. I've been a nurse in the ER at Methodist for about 9 years, and it concerns me this House File 261, which would allow some non-nurse practicing of nursing duties in the home environment. I've had some firsthand know-how to this program operates. A few departments implemented this project due to, of course, increased 911 calls from post-discharge from hospital patients. And these patients mostly were confused about their discharge summary and medication changes. Not only does this raise cost for the EMS system with all the 911 calls, but with hospital reimbursement being changed with the Affordable Care Act and seeing more readmission with patients, this is our understanding why this program's been put into place. In the ER, I have a lot of contact with various departments and first responders, and I can tell you that they're not all the same. There's different training levels. Some use firefighters or volunteer services to bring patients into us. Some are paramedics, EMTs. The report level is different from each of them as to the information we gather when a patient comes into the ER. And anybody can take vital signs, but it's what you do with that information that's dependent on your training. As a nurse, I'm trained and licensed to assess, intervene, and most importantly, reassess patients. But there's more to being a nurse than knowing what a temperature or a blood pressure means to a patient. A head-to-toe assessment may be the most important thing that I do all day in my role, which is something EMTs may not have the time or training to do in the field or in a home environment. Every time I see you or another nurse sees you or talks to you, even if it's just to say good morning or how are you doing, I'm actually assessing you. Even if just for a minute, I'm making mental notes that later I'm going to chart. I'm looking, I'm listening, I'm feeling. I'm looking at the color of your skin, the moisture of your skin, if you're guarding or holding yourself as a physical indicator of pain and other things happening. And I'm listening to how much pain you're in or what your complaints are. In a home environment, it's no different. A nurse can assess how a patient is doing and intervene. Let's say I come to see you, and one thing I do is get you up and help you walk around or do a road test, as we call it. I'm looking to see if you're a falls risk, how you're getting around your home. Sometimes you might test someone and realize things need to be decluttered, a rug removed, that there may need to be rails or supports installed in the bathroom or other places in the house. Maybe you're using a cane, crutches, or walker that inhibit your ability. Sometimes you may realize they're quickly out of breath. Maybe they're a smoker, they have a history of emphysema, or maybe they acquired something in the hospital that needs further intervention. So I can stick a pulse oximeter, or anybody can, on a patient and get a reading, but without a real assessment, that may not be the whole story. A home health nurse would also notice if you have your meds set up correctly. Do you have a system to remember how and when to take them and how often? We want to know if you're looking strong or weak at home. Maybe weakness is just because you're having trouble eating. You're not getting the proper nutrition, which could be affecting your recovery. That begins a whole stream of questions to be answered, such as, is anyone there to cook for you, help you get groceries? We work pretty fast in the ER, but we look at other issues beyond just bleeding cuts. We're always checking off all the assessment boxes each time we see someone. And finally, I have to mention this. The core problem isn't how we can take better care of patients at home. What we really need to address here is how we can take better care of patients before they ever leave the hospital. We need to make sure nurses, doctors, and staff have the time that they need to assess, educate, and counsel every patient properly when they're discharged. We're so rushed at the hospital handling more and more patients at one time, the basic chores of taking care of people are slipping by. Every extra hour somebody can spend with the patient before they go home means time saved in recovery and the time that they would call for help again on how to get better. In many cases, this means calling 911 yet again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Enger. And Representative McDonald has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Representative Mack, now, your bill particularly deals with the patients, with the individuals that are out of the hospital already, right? We're not talking about replacing a nurse who's very important and great work they do at the hospital and caring for those who need it. This is done afterwards and in addition to. Is that correct?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald. That's absolutely the case. Certainly, EMTs would not be dispersed to go work in the hospitals. We more or less see this as the continuum of care. Once they're released from the care of the hospital and the good work that's been done there, we see it as a partnership that something like this would allow other healthcare workers that we have, people that have the resources and could partner with the medical community to make sure that all of the things that have been spelled out are followed up on immediately after admission to try to stem off some of those 911 calls.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's fair to say they kind of will cement the work that a nurse or physician does in the hospital.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative McDonald. Yes, that is the case, and certainly to, you know, where there's questions or ambiguity, as was alluded to in earlier testimony, bring clarity, point them in the right direction where they, you know, get a hold of their primary care physician. And as you read the bill, there are some specifics in terms of, you know, this work would be done as part of a patient care plan under the director or under the supervision of a medical director. Some of that's spelled out in the bill, so it's certainly not done ad hoc or, you know, willy-nilly. It is done with a specific set of criteria.
Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you could add EN to your acronym for CEMENT instead of CMT, CEMENT. The good work that the nurses and doctors do was my suggestion for the acronym. But on a serious note, in looking on your bill, you know, the first responder, this would deal with first responders as well, correct?
Representative Mack.
Yes, that is my understanding. We can have the expert speak to that, but that's my understanding.
Yeah, and as, sorry, Mr. Chair.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, and as we know, the first responders in a community often are the firemen and the EMTs, and of course they're saving lives right there on the noggin, right on the spot. And I know in Delano and Wright County, that was the case in many people. And in our small local communities, there are headlines on the front page, and we've seen it for years. So how do then, if they qualify for medical assistance, how does the funding go? I see that in your bill regarding the, if they qualify for medical assistance, where does that money go to? Is that the cities then, or how does that funding mechanism work?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could... maybe if we finish out the final testifier, and then we'll bring the other folks forward to speak to some of the more meat and some of this technical pieces of the bill, that might be helpful. I think I know the answer to that, but there's probably a clearer answer from somebody else. So,
all right, Representative Mack. And the other questions, could they hold off for the other ones, or are they directed specifically to Ms. Enger? Okay. All right. If we could have Matt Keller. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record. Tell us where you work and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good afternoon. My name is Matthew Keller. I'm a nurse as well as an attorney. I'm the nursing practice and policy expert for the Minnesota Nurses Association. The Minnesota Nurses Association commends Representative Mack for putting forth a bill aimed at improving health care through preventing hospital readmissions. We do, however, have several concerns with the current version of HF 261. First, the bill does not adequately protect the public from unlicensed personnel practicing beyond their training and expertise. Second, The bill increases fragmentation of care in an already fragmented healthcare system. Lastly, we question whether the Emergency Medical Services Board is the appropriate board to monitor non-emergency services. First, the Community Health EMT Bill does not adequately protect community health from unlicensed personnel practicing beyond their training and expertise. Having been an Army nurse with thousands of hours of experience working side-by-side EMTs, I have a great amount of respect for their ability to treat acute and emergent conditions in austere environments. The knowledge and ability of EMTs in emergency care is not to be questioned. However, it is important to remember that an EMT certification requires only 120 hours of training. This equates to about half of one college semester. Furthermore, those 120 hours are dedicated to teaching EMTs the things they need to know in order to fulfill their role, which is to operate in emergency situations. Requiring two additional years of experience, riding an ambulance is a good start, but also does not provide the necessary education or experience to provide home-based, non-emergency care. Because of this, MNA supports a bill that clearly delineates the roles and responsibilities of the community EMT. The current engrossment allows EMTs to practice episodic population health support, and the amendment only removes that one spot in the bill. There is another location. Individual patient education, population-based prevention education programs, care coordination, diagnosis-related patient education, and any interventions intended to prevent emergency department use or ambulance transportation. These broad terms are overly vague and ambiguous, especially for individuals with only 120 hours of formalized training. Take, for example, interventions intended to prevent ambulance transport emergency department use. Considering that the main goal of nearly all preventive and primary care is to promote healthy living and prevent emergency department use, interventions intended to prevent ambulance transport slash emergency department use can conceivably apply to just about any medical or nursing intervention. Managing chronic diabetes through daily administration of insulin is an intervention intended to prevent ambulance transport. Correcting a fluid deficiency status through administering IV fluids is an intervention intended to prevent emergency department use. Delivering a baby is an intervention intended to prevent ambulance transport. For this reason, the Minnesota Nurses Association recommends amending HF 261 in a way that details the specific tasks to be performed by CEMTs rather than relying upon the professional judgment of technicians with less than 120 hours of formalized training. If the purpose of this bill is to allow CEMTs to check medications and medical appointments, then one questions why the bill is not narrowly tailored to suit that purpose. Delineating the specific tasks to be performed by a CEMT within the home-based setting will A, clearly communicate to CEMTs what their role is within the healthcare team, B, allow CEMTs to operate within the spirit of what is intended by this bill, and C, protect the public from unlicensed personnel practicing nursing or medicine beyond their knowledge and experience. Second, this bill increases the fragmentation of care in an already fragmented healthcare system. It's important to remember that many of the services which could be offered were this bill to pass are already offered in other areas of the healthcare system. Hospitals already have teams of nurses that check in with patients after hospital admissions in order to ensure the discharge plan is being followed, medications have been filled, appointments have been made, and any questions have been asked and answered. The LifeSpark team at North Memorial, for example, has had great success with this approach. There are also home care agencies, public health nurses, and primary care physicians with overlapping duties and responsibilities in this realm. Adding a community EMT to the mix causes further fragmentation of this care. The proposed amendment to this bill purportedly eliminates some of the fragmentation by disallowing CEMTs from practicing home care services provided by other healthcare professionals. However, the amendment does nothing to prevent CEMTs from practicing within the scope of practice of other professions so long as such practices do not constitute home care services. For example, performing advanced wound care is traditionally and legally a nursing task, but not necessarily a home care nurse task. Therefore, the proposed amendment would not prevent a CEMT from practicing advanced wound care, despite a lack of training and experience in managing such chronic care tasks. For this reason, we propose that the bill be amended to specifically prohibit CEMTs from practicing within the scope of nursing practice. Lastly, MNA questions whether the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board is the appropriate board to monitor non-emergency services. For example, what is the Emergency Board's experience in analyzing complaints regarding non-emergency care? What is the Emergency Board's experience in determining the appropriate legal and ethical guidelines for non-emergent situations? Are the individuals on the board the most qualified individuals to analyze home-based cares? These and other questions must be analyzed in the appropriate context. For that reason, we propose that other options be explored for board oversight. In conclusion, the Minnesota Nurses Association encourages this committee to 1. Amend the bill to remove overly broad and ambiguous terms and insert a specific list of tasks that may be performed in order to better protect the public. 2. Amend the bill in such a way so as to specifically prohibit CEMTs from practicing within the scope of nursing practice. And 3. Explore other options for regulatory board oversight. Thank you for the time. I'm happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. We do have one question specifically for Mr. Keller. That is Representative Hamilton. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Keller, the last testifier, Ms. Enger, I think I heard her correctly. She said one of the main issues is the labor shortage. I think I had that right. Could you please speak to that as far as the labor shortage as it pertains to nurses?
Mr. Keller.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hamilton, it's true that there is somewhat of a misnomer regarding a labor shortage in the nursing profession. As a matter of fact, however, the state of Minnesota last year licensed over 6,000 nurses, whereas only 1,800 were able to find full-time work within the profession. So there are adequate amount of nurses to fill these roles, and that leads to a broader point of whether or not public health nurses are best suited to be the ones providing these cares, but that's an issue beyond the scope of this bill.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I was listening to Representative McDonald. And as I think about this, and you know, the questions are being raised, and that's right, that's what we should be doing here, and I'm glad the bill's going to be laid over because it sounds like maybe there's room for a little more work. Nursing is being practiced, you know, inside the walls of a hospital, outside the walls of a hospital. Like, you know, nursing is practiced in caring for people who are pregnant in their homes, who have had a new baby in their homes, in hospice, for people who are aging. And that they're not the only provider of home care services, but certainly are a part of that complement. And so when I think about this legislation, I think we have to figure out how those things fit together and help. And nobody from the Hospital Association is here right now, but I think more care is going to be provided outside the walls of the hospitals as we go forward in time. And I don't know that that is a threat to the hospitals, but we're going to see that change. And so as we're building that infrastructure, which is a part of what we're talking about today, I think we have to be mindful about how those roles fit together. So for me, this isn't so much a question of yes or no, but how we make them fit to make sure the delegatory role from a medical director isn't so broad for an EMT that people are doing things in the home that they're not prepared for. I took care of people in their homes just for a little while. And the question that came about whether or not someone has food is a really great question. And I was taking care of a woman who, she had a GI cancer in her bowel, and it was growing so slowly, it was obstructing her bowel, and she was, you know, she was heading toward hospice. And she had plenty of food in her refrigerator. In fact, she had too much food in her refrigerator because she wasn't eating anything. And we had to figure out how to help her get the nutrition she needed so she didn't waste. And that was, for me, a complicated nursing skill. And I had to work, of course, with other providers to figure that out so that she got the right nutrition. I want to make sure as we're building the infrastructure outside of the walls of the hospital that we've got the right complement of providers who can do what we're describing in this piece of legislation, I think, which is to check in with people after they've been discharged to make sure they're on their feet. But I also want to make sure that they are relating to the other providers that are providing care in the home so that we don't see people readmitted, so they are, you know, as healthy as they can be with whatever condition they're facing. And so I just want to bring that up because you were talking about it, and I think they fit together, and it raises the issue that I think is important for this piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Representative Mack, does your bill replace public health nurses with EMTs?
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Schoen. It absolutely does not.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Mack, I wonder if you would just respond to the issue about what board would be supervising these practitioners. You know, I thought that was a kind of an interesting concern, one that I hadn't heard before. like to hear kind of how that decision was made.
Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Liebling, if it is okay, I will actually bring forward Mr. McAlpin. To be honest, that was a concern that was brought to me earlier today, so I'm not well-versed in how we came to that, and so I'm just going to refer to the stakeholders who have been working in detail on this particular piece.
Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, Buck McAlpin, Minnesota Ambulance Association. The Minnesota EMS Regulatory Board, paramedics and EMTs are unique in Minnesota. We're one of a few states that are exempt from scope of practice in statute. And secondly, as alluded to earlier, work under the medical director's license of an ambulance service or a first responder squad. So in order to be registered with the state EMS board, we all have to have a medical director. In the community paramedic world, I work with North Memorial. We have about 12 of them out there right now. They work under jointly with our ambulance medical director and our primary care medical director. In relationship to which board is the best, most states that are going towards legislation are sticking in the EMS board because we do non-emergency ambulance transportation. Not everything the board oversees from complaint review or for EMS work is emergency work. Quite a bit of it is non-emergency transportation, stretcher work, interfacility stuff, and things like that. Our board's unique in Minnesota that it's made up of primary care docs, rural docs, nurses, paramedics, EMTs, firefighters, and quite a cadre of folks that sit in subgroups and look at what we do with these type of extensions. And great discussion around this bill. Representative Murphy brings up some good points. And one thing is just trying to figure out some of the definitions. And if I look at them, I could interpret them 100 different ways over what population health even is to me. And I think those are things we can look at and work on. But we have felt from both community paramedic and the community EMT side is the biggest piece that's still the most value to our independent EMS board, I think, in all my years doing this, is the complaint review panel. We needed a spot if somebody had a complaint against going into someone's home, whether it's an ambulance 911 call or a community EMT or paramedic call, that there is a venue for the public to be protected. So the EMS board enables us to do that under that model.
Mm-hmm. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. So I'm kind of, am I correct in understanding then that some of this supervision is because of the relationship you're describing with the medical directors, that the medical director is in some sense responsible, you know, under this bill, the medical director has to send somebody out to do something specific, and if that person does it incorrectly, oversteps their bounds, those kind of things, is that medical director responsible?
Mr. McAlpin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, yes. We work under their license directly.
Okay, thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to respond to Representative Murphy's comments and certainly agree with you. I think we have a bigger issue, and that's why I support Representative Mack's bill, because it kind of lays out, in a way, what Representative Murphy was saying in her sections from 3.1 to 3.2. It consults, you know, it asks the Commissioner of Human Services to consult representatives from the emergency medical service, physicians, public health nurses, community health workers, Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association, Minnesota Professional Fires Association, and public health agencies, determine what's best for these individuals and to help intervene in intended to prevent avoidable ambulance and transmission, transportation, and hospital emergency department use. So it coordinates all that care together, and again, I'll just use that corny statement, the cement. It cements together, at least my interpretation, the work that the physicians and nurses had done in the hospitals. So, you know, I think at this point we get it. Everybody's protecting their turf. Hey, this is my job. Don't take my job this way from me. But we have a greater issue facing our nation with the silver tsunami. We've heard that term 17,000 to 18,000 times. And if we don't all gather together to come up with solutions, we're going to we'll have a collapse, I think, financially and otherwise. And I think Representative Mack's bill does that. So I think it's just a matter of getting all the teams together. And your bill does that through the Commissioner of Health Services to coordinate it together. And then I'll just, if you offer a little suggestion on your acronym. So CEMENT, Community Emergency Medical Efficiency Nurturing Technician. What do you think? You like that? Because they have to nurture. They have to be efficient. They have to care. And with that, I...
All those opposed? No. Nope. Representative Mack.
I had one up here. Miss Crinky liked it. Thank you, Mary.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. You know, I think it's interesting the way we're seeing some of these bills come through with the community paramedic and now the community EMT. And I think this is kind of the trend we're seeing, especially with the federal level and the Affordable Care Act, and looking at the kind of rigid punitive nature that's rolling into when you look at the penalties and the reimbursement penalties that will be imposed upon hospitals that have too high a higher grade of hospital readmission rates. And so clearly what, from a federal level, what the model is doing is trying to keep people, push them out of the hospital as efficiently as possible, and then to make sure that there's enough follow-up care and there's a system in place to, once they get out of the hospital, to keep them out of the hospital and healthy. And so I think this is a sign of kind of a broader federal strategy that occurred that we're seeing kind of the ramifications of, because it's about readmission rates. And I think, you know, I understand, you know, nurses have a very vital and important role in taking care of their patients. I know I spent a lot of time in the hospital. My favorite nurse, Scott, was a male nurse. And he was there. Even when I didn't have anyone else to talk to, he was there for me. And he provided that level of care. But I think there's a role for that. And then there's a role that we need to say, how can we provide this type of care as cost-effectively as appropriate? And so I think after we saw with the advanced practice nurse bill, I think there's a danger. There's a danger in saying, well, is that my scope of practice or is that your scope of practice? You know, the Nurses Association with the APRN bill was 100% fine in looking at their providers going above and beyond and reaching to the full capacity of their duties. And so I think you should be very cautious now when you're looking at another provider that maybe has a niche or a role to fill in a less intense environment, to say, oh, wait. It was fine for us to expand to the top of our scope, but now that someone else wants to look at that in a way to provide more effective and efficient health care, because that was our argument with the APRN bill. I think that word of caution that I'll say is it's one thing to be good in all four, efficient care and practicing the top of your practice when it's about your profession. But when it's another complementing profession, I think you have to understand how the system works and understand that we're all trying to deliver health care to everyone's top of their practice within their scope, and to have a collaborative healthcare environment that takes care of our patients. That's what this is all about. We need to get people out of the hospital in great care, do that follow-up care, that make sure they're taking their meds, they have what they need, and they're set up for success, because we don't want them coming back. That's all, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to that point, Representative Zerwas, I have, and so have the nurses, supported the community health worker and the community paramedic. So I don't think it would be right to conclude that because they have questions about this legislation that they haven't worked collaboratively to look at other scopes. And I do think the question for us is not whether, but how they fit together.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. And I had a question kind of off of Representative Zerwas's questions. You know, you get a 30-year-old with a knee operation, next day they're bounced out home. You get a 79, 80-year-old, it's a little bit of a different deal. But, you know, we have the same expectations about getting people scooted out of the hospital as quickly as possible today as opposed to years ago. So we're seeing people with more acute situations who need a little bit more care at home. aftercare, so it seems like it makes some sense. Just looking at the cost of the bill in the fiscal note, most of the costs seem to be pretty light and system-wide. Is there costs projected that are billed costs? In other words, let's say somebody's going to get home care and billed Medicaid or whoever their payer is, that goes through. Has that been anticipated with this bill for either additional costs or less costs or how that might work?
Mr. Chair, Buck McAlpin, that's a great question. Medicaid for the community paramedic pays us $60 an hour, billed in 15-minute increments. And then there are things we work on the commercial side with our payers that we work on. But the majority of the community paramedic program is not supported off user fees. It is supported off our contracting relationships with our friends in the health plans to say, let's look at a population, let's target it, and let's reduce the total cost of care. So when we take the populations and look at them to make the hospital viable financially, we have to get pretty aggressive with what we do. So Alina, Hennepin County, North Memorial, Health East have the big community paramedic programs, and about 5 or 7% of our total payment for North Memorial, I can tell you, is based off some very interesting and aggressive targets for total cost of care. So that is where we do better. Recently in the Integrated Health Demonstration Project, we were one of three, and our community paramedics with the nurses managed 5,000 Medicaid folks, and we got an $800,000 bonus for meeting our targets for decreasing the total cost of care. So we partner very closely with nursing and home health within our system to be sure that we achieve those goals and outcomes. So for the community EMT side, I know that Park Nicollet has talked about some numbers where they've reduced readmissions, and I would guess as we move forward, and the thing to still remember is there's nothing that would require anybody in statute or not statute to have these folks show up today and do this work anyway. The fire services came forward and the first responders and the advanced EMTs and said, let's professionalize this and make sure that we have some type of training when we're going out into their homes and doing this one-day visit that we do. And part of this legislation talks about over the interim that we would work with DHS and all the stakeholders to address a lot of the issues that Representative Murphy brought up, like we did with community paramedics, with the nurses, to address, is there some type of reimbursement to do that? And I know on our congestive heart failure patients in our system and our ER readmissions, we have saw over 50% reduction in reutilization by just following up with folks. And I think Representative Zerwas hit it on the head, Mr. Chair, about the populations. We just have such a massive population that has turned to the healthcare system for everything from social services, housing, transportation, that this is just a tool that we use to help keep the system afloat and make it work. And as fragmented as it seems at times, I've never seen healthcare systems align so well as I have the last few years around some pretty aggressive care coordination that I think we're starting to see the fruits of the labor move forward, whether you're in outstate Minnesota or in the metro area.
Thank you, Mr. McAlpin. And if you wouldn't mind, just really quickly just walk me through kind of how somebody might, how this might be teed up as a service. Who gets the call? How do they, you know, schedule it, deliver it, and then how do they bill for it, and who do they send the bill to?
Great question. Mr. Chair, for our population, and the community paramedic would marry the community EMT. There is quite a flow sheet. When a patient is identified, whether in the emergency department or primary care, and lots of times our ambulance crews will go in the ER and say, hey, Dr. Hamilton, this guy's called us 7 times this week. We're picking somebody up for the same abdominal pain. We need to get him a community paramedic visit or somebody follow up with him. Then they're referred over to our primary care side where two things happen. They're either put in our medical home or they get a care plan. Like the community EMT bill, we never roguely go out and see somebody. We have to have that patient assigned to us. As they go down the tree, if the person qualifies for home health care, they go to home health care to be seen. One, because it's reimbursed better, and two, that's a nursing procedure for that level of care. If they have no coverage or they don't qualify, and I still try to learn the world of in-home and homebound for Medicare, if they don't qualify for those services and they continue to go down the tree, that the community paramedic sees them. We do see lots of Medicare patients today that we are not reimbursed for, but just folks that need to have some type of follow-up. But our preference is our CPs meet 3 times a week in what's called a huddle,
with our home health care and our primary care division to look through the huge list of people to say, boy, Holly's called 17 times this week. There's something going on at the house. And we got to swing by there and make sure that's okay. And then that's how our CPs, three of them on a day, 16 hours a day, are assigned a patient that they go and see. And if they fall into the Medicaid, so really the big population we're billing for is the Medicaid ones. And if those qualify for home health too, they default to home health. And I would see the CMT program, we're working on setting that up the same way if there is a payment methodology developed next year.
Thank you. And just last up, the one of the other things that popped into my head, if they are returning to obviously not an emergency situation, they're just returning for follow-up to somebody's house for care, follow-up care, do you have to provide translator services?
Mr. Chair, we do.
Thank you. Any other questions? Seeing none, Representative Mack, anything else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just want to point out for members' comfort and some of the issues that were brought forward, specifically on page 3 about some of the terms that were used. I just want to put that in the context that's explaining that the Commissioner of Human Services, along with all of the groups outlined, including the Minnesota Nurses Association, will work together to determine the specified services. And so that work will be done in collaboration under the direction of the commissioner. We're not kind of throwing that to the wind. That is something to continue to be worked on and then brought back to the legislature next February. And the other piece in terms of the fragmentation of care and the scope issues that got talked about, for any of us that have sat on Health and Human Services for any amount of time, the scope conversations are continually ongoing. They are never black and white. I think a lot of times when we come in, we think, oh, you know, scopes will have nice, clear lines, and they just simply don't. And so it's a difficult conversation to have to figure out, particularly in healthcare, and I think any healthcare worker is looking to advance the health of their patients and work in collaboration with everyone else. And certainly there's issues of fragmentation, but I actually see this bill as a step towards addressing some of the fragmentation and making sure that there's a better continuum of care. And so I appreciate the support of the committee, and we'll certainly continue to work on concerns, but I think we're very close to being a pretty good product. So thank you, members of the committee and Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Mack. And with that, Representative Mack renews her motion that House File 261 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The House File 261 is laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Mack, thank you. Testifiers, thank you. And advocates and members, we are adjourned.